From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is being made in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at a manufacturing firm that employs 100 people. It's called Allegheny Technologies. It's a metal fabricator. And now it might have to close. The owner, Robert Weatherby, wrote a piece for the Wall Street Journal explaining that the Trump tariffs have caused his plant to hemorrhage money. His company imports stainless steel slab from Indonesia, then turns it into sheet metal, which becomes car parts and kitchen appliances and other products. And Weatherby writes, quote, "Tariffs are blunt instruments and have harmed many American companies, including my own," end quote. So perhaps you expect that Weatherby is calling for an end to these tariffs, or even a new president. You would be wrong. Weatherby is a Trump supporter, a firm one. A committed one. He explains that despite the damage tariffs have done, and despite the fact that his own company might go out of business, he supports the Trump tariffs. He just wants others to pay them. He is asking for an exemption for himself. Seriously, the actual headline in the Wall Street Journal is, "I support Trump's tariffs, but need an exemption." And so here we are. Even when things are terrible, nothing seems to matter. That is, politically at least. But things most certainly matter in regards to life and death, war, geopolitics. This hour, we have our eyes on a wide range of places, from Brexit to Iran, of course, from Russia to China. And our guest is Randy Stone, the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester and a professor of political science. And what is it that you're teaching in the spring?
Starting next week, I'm teaching Introduction to International Political Economy.
Will you talk about tariffs?
Sure, glad to.
Will you talk about it with your students?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. And and China certainly comes up. Last time I taught this, the tariffs on China were just ramping up. And so the Trump administration provided a good illustration for class just about every day. One of the things that I point out in this class, and teach a certain amount of basic economics along with politics and history, is that, you know, trade balances are caused by the difference between savings and investment. This is a fairly introductory economics point. You can demonstrate it with a very little bit of math, and it works out empirically quite well, that countries that save more than they invest have surplus in their trade, and countries that invest more than they save have deficit in their trade. Well, the United States is not a heavy saving country. China is, and so the United States has a structural deficit vis-a-vis China, and that's going to be the case regardless of what the level of tariffs are, right? So if you increase tariffs, you're going to decrease U.S. Imports from China, but you're going to decrease Chinese imports from the United States by roughly the same amount, right? Because there's an effect on the exchange rate, which essentially cancels out the effect of the tariff. So you lower the total amount of trade, but you don't change the trade balance, right? And over very short periods of time, it can look like tariffs work to balance trade, but over the long term, it just doesn't work.
The hard part for me, not being an economist and someone trying to be sort of intellectually honest and talk in good faith about what I do and don't understand about tariffs, is that when you talk to, and this is a generalization, but when you talk to workers in plants, we talk to auto workers, for example, many have told us from very different political backgrounds that they like tariffs. They feel like it is a way of voicing support for the American worker. And so it can be used as sort of a rallying cry for some sort of patriotic economics plan. However, you know, it's not just an academic idea that tariffs can be painful. What Weatherby's writing in the Wall Street Journal is he's a Trump supporter and his plant could close because of the tariffs. That's not academic. That's not ivory tower. That is real world. Do you expect
That's
to see
right.
more of this kind of an impact that Weatherby describes?
Oh, yes. I mean, tariffs have very real economic impacts. They will decrease economic activity in the United States and in China. There will be a whole series of transactions that were profitable that aren't going to be profitable anymore. And so lines of business are going to have to close down. Our economies are so heavily interdependent at this point that numerous products are exported back and forth between the United States and China, or various levels of assembly are done in China of products that are produced all over East Asia, right? And American firms have invested heavily in China because that's the way for them to develop competitive advantage vis-a-vis European firms or Japanese firms, right? So we live in a global economy where not only trade is interdependent and interpenetrating, but production has become globalized, right? The United States doesn't produce cars anymore. We produce car parts and we assemble cars, right? And this is true of most complex products, right? That they're assembled based on parts that are produced all over the world. There are a lot of gains to the world economy from this practice, and has led to very dramatic increases in growth rates. But it means that when you start disrupting these value chains, as they're called, you can cause all kinds of unanticipated ripple effects.
So we're going to return to tariffs next week on the program, listeners, in particular because we have some listeners who work in, for example, wine importing. There is some serious concern about some changes in the offing and the rules and tariffs there. We'll talk about that next week. But last question on this subject, and then we're going to move to Iran in just a moment here. But maybe this is a question for your colleagues in the sociology department, but it's probably for you because you teach political science too. When Weatherby describes himself as a Trump supporter, often the idea is, okay, you own a metal fabrication plant, you're a Trump supporter. The only thing that might make you change your mind on Trump is if you have to go out of business over one of his policies, which literally might happen. And his determination is to say, I'm still going to support him, and I will support the policy that could put my plant out of business. I will just ask to be excluded from it. What is going on sociologically, or at least sort of in the political minds of Americans, when nothing, almost nothing, can move people off of whatever their particular candidate is?
This is really interesting, and this is something we're seeing across the board. If you interview workers in Ohio who were convinced that Trump was going to somehow turn around their fortunes, and things are not getting better for them, and their towns are still ghost towns. All the businesses have moved out. Or you talk to farmers across the Midwest, and they're being hurt tremendously by tariffs on soybeans. Now there's been a bit of a respite on that particular front, but the damage to U.S. agricultural exports was really severe, and there wasn't much of a budge in support for Donald Trump. People were willing to say, "Well, it's not working, but I trust that it will work sometime in the future." Or maybe it's not working for me, but I think it'll work out overall in the end. It's been remarkable how resilient his support has been among his core supporters. It doesn't matter what he does or what he says or how crazy his policy positions become. There are certain people who are just dialed in and convinced. And they seem to live in impervious bubbles that prevent the penetration of new information.
And I would just say to listeners, if you want to join the program, and in particular to listeners who are supporting the president, this isn't meant to be a knock on the president. This is more just understanding the sociology of Americans who are directly impacted by policies. And Weatherby in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is a great example. I mean, literally, the plant's going to close here, and maybe you're going to argue, well, look, you can ask for an exemption to tariffs. I think they're called exclusions, but you know, it is legitimate to ask for them. But as Reason magazine, not a liberal magazine, but a libertarian publication, points out, his request for an exclusion would be sort of bunk. It would be self-serving. And it would amount to, I want everyone else to pay except for me. So it's just an interesting way of sort of trying to understand the psychology and of the American sort of political voter, not just Trump supporters, but it's an interesting political moment. Randy Stone is our guest here, and we're going to talk about a range of issues. If you want to join the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. What went through your mind first when you heard about the strike on Soleimani?
Well, I was rather shocked. I mean, the United States does not ordinarily practice assassination, right? And taking out a high-level official of a foreign government with whom we are not at war is an act of assassination. And I imagined all sorts of potential consequences. And then as I'm not a Middle East expert, as I began to inform myself about the role that he plays or played in the Iranian political system and the symbolic importance that he had in Iraq and in Lebanon, Syria, and a variety of other places, became clear that this was a very momentous decision, and one which had all sorts of consequences that the administration had not prepared for in any way. So it seems like a classic Trump bungle, where they take some sort of an impetuous action, have not thought through what the consequences are, and then of course they double down on it. Well, no, we knew exactly what we were doing. We had it all planned out. This is part of a grand strategy. He was planning something, and so of course we had to stop him. All the defenses start to be brought out, but it's clear from the consequences that followed, like the Iraqi parliament voting to expel U.S. troops after 17 years of war, they didn't anticipate what was going to happen. It's just sheer incompetence.
And we see the images. In fact, Tehran was quick to allow American journalists in to cover the funeral and some of the public demonstrations, probably because they want the West to see how this has galvanized the Iranian street, so to speak. I saw an interview, Martha Raddatz from ABC News was there and interviewed a man, a clip sort of went viral, where he's crying on the street and he said, "We do not hate Americans. We love Americans. We hate your president." That's what the man was saying. But to see the way this has galvanized, at least for the moment, the people of Iran, I mean, protesting and demonstrating, coming out for these public funerals by the tens upon tens of thousands, and yet, just hours before those funerals, we heard some of the same pundits who predicted that in Iraq in 2003 we'd be greeted with roses and cheers as liberators. The same sort of pundits were saying, "Well, Soleimani wasn't all that popular in Iran anyway, and Iranian people might view this as actually helpful to them." It does not seem to be the case, again, from what we can observe so far.
Well, there's nothing to elevate someone's popularity like assassinating them. And it's striking to me that in the weeks prior to this event, there were a lot of protests in Iran. The protests had been ramping up, and they were critical of the regime. Right? The regime really looked like it was on the ropes. People were taking substantial personal risks, because it is a fairly repressive regime, to come out and protest publicly against the government. And that's all done now, right? With this one stroke, we seem to have unified the Iranian population behind its government and reinforced all of the most sort of reactionary tendencies of that government. Now, the Iranian political system is kind of complicated. It has, it does have elections, although those elections are manipulated. Public opinion does play a role in the regime, and so they oscillate between really hardline and just moderately hardline governments. And the current Rouhani government was very willing to make a deal with the Obama administration, was hoped to push through some reforms, was hoping that a respite in the tension with the United States would provide some political space where some sort of more creative possibilities could be explored. And unfortunately, when Trump came in and suspended the Iranian nuclear deal and intensified conflict and so forth, that just shifted all of the leverage back to the hardliners. And so here we are.
What do you now, what are your fears vis-a-vis Iran, and what do you suspect we are going to see next? Because there's been a lot of speculation about Tehran's response, the firing of missiles at an Iraqi base that housed Americans. And there was some suspicion that Tehran telegraphed that move to make sure that there were no casualties. There apparently were not any casualties. And now there's the speculation that, well, that was just a show, but they had to save face and fire some missiles, and now we can all move on. What are your fears, and do you think that that's a realistic hope, that we can move on now?
Well, it seems like if you're interested in avoiding U.S. casualties, the last thing you say is, well, they didn't really mean it. They were just trying to save face. All right. If you believe that that's true, then you should afford them the opportunity to save a little bit of face, and maybe they won't launch more missiles at you. But the administration's rapid seizing upon this argument seems calculated for the American domestic audience to bolster their standing at home and to try to win some political points, irrespective of what the consequences are in the Middle East. I think it is true that saving face is important for an authoritarian regime that has based its legitimacy on hostility to the West. And so if this volley of missiles didn't succeed in doing that, and I'm sure the Iranian population is reading what the Americans are saying in the press, then they'll be compelled to take some further action.
So just sort of dancing in the end zone of that publicly as a way to stoke perhaps further action. There's also concern that Tehran could respond in many other ways, with perhaps assassination, some kind of cyber attacks, et cetera. I mean, it's way beyond my expertise and capacity to understand what they're capable of. But is this the kind of event that you think will have ripples for a long time, or do you think that this could be stemmed, Randy?
Well, I would expect that it will have a long-term impact. And the concern that I have is that every interaction with Iran that strengthens the credibility of the arguments made by the hardliners in Iran has very long-term negative consequences for stability in the region and for U.S. national security. That interactions with Iran that bolster the arguments of the liberals that, well, maybe it's possible to live with the United States. Maybe if we do something, it's possible to get a rational accommodation. Those sorts of interactions can lessen the danger of conflict over the long term. This kind of tit-for-tat escalation can very easily get out of control. It looks like it didn't get out of control on Tuesday, and maybe it won't get out of control. And it may be that we'll be talking in a couple weeks about the looming conflict with some other country that Trump decides to pick a fight with. But it does seem like a dangerous situation.
Two other points on that before we go to some phone calls on this subject. This is a president who spent literally 3 years on social media at the start of the last decade, or perhaps this decade if you want to be pedantic about it, complaining and predicting that Barack Obama would attack Iran as a political boost, as a move for political gain. He essentially said Iran is the easiest target to try for a president like Obama to try to attack simply for political gain. I mean, he spent almost 3 years predicting that. It did not happen with the Obama administration. Should we remind ourselves of that as we try to take into account his possible motivations?
Well, clearly it's an idea that has occurred to him before. He must have seen the movie Wag the Dog. And he kind of knows that this is a play that he might contemplate. It is a concern. I mean, this is a president who is on the ropes and on several fronts, and there is a lot of reason to worry. I think that as irresponsible as he's shown himself to be, self-serving as his administration has been, he would be the last president where I would rule out the idea that he would manipulate foreign affairs to his own personal advantage.
And for those who say that Soleimani was a, quote, bad guy, that he, and by the way, I'm not here at all to defend Soleimani, but the justification for the hit seems to be, well, He did bad things. The issue I have with that is Vladimir Putin has done some terrible things. The leadership of North Korea has done some terrible things. And our president hangs out and does photo ops with the leadership of North Korea and talks about how he has a love affair with Kim Jong-un and how he has a friendship and he gets Putin. So if your baseline is bad guy deserves to be taken out, I don't necessarily see the consistency. Do you?
Well, no, but I wouldn't want to urge Trump to be consistent in this respect and take out all the bad guys.
I hear you. I understand. That
would really be playing with fire. But I think, sure, there are lots of people who are perhaps deserving of punishment. But political assassination is not a legitimate way of enforcing international order or international law, right? Political assassination is ruled out of international law for very good reasons, because it is it's explosive. It leads to escalation. It's very counterproductive. I can't think of a political assassination that actually achieved any useful goal.
Noah Rothman of Commentary, who has been, I think you would probably call him a neocon, and I think he probably would describe himself that way. Max Boot, people like Max and Noah have been big critics of President Trump, but have been largely defending this hit on Soleimani, saying that this is how deterrence works. You hit hard and you show them that you can hit harder if they're not careful. You send it as a warning shot, and that this is going to work as a deterrence factor. What do you think?
Well, today's New York Times was saying that this was a view that Mike Pompeo has been promoting, that specifically targeting Soleimani would help to reestablish deterrence, which is the catchphrase that he's been using with regard to Iran. I don't think that assassination works that way. I guess the calculation would have to be that you're deterring individual Iranians, that they should keep their heads down and not become too prominent, or else they might be next on the U.S. hit list, right? You certainly don't deter a nation state that way. But I don't think that there's any shortage of people to step into Soleimani's shoes, and they will be more motivated than ever. So to the extent that you deter anyone from becoming a leading figure in Iran who's hostile to the United States, you may be just deterring the more cautious ones, and the ones who will end up taking those positions will be less cautious.
Let me get Teddy in Rochester first on the phone. Go ahead, Teddy.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It seems as though Americans who are feeling as though this is a proper action, that we're taking out the bad guys, are not very aware of their own history. It seems as though people believe the idea of imperialists like Teddy Roosevelt, who say, speak softly and carry a big stick, and don't remember that, you know, the Spanish-American War was almost completely instigated by that man. Not only that, but to say that we can arbitrarily create justice by murder puts us in this perspective of we're in charge. And I would say that, you know, if we really are in charge, then maybe we should manage our affairs with a little more tact and subtlety. But now that that's obviously not the case, and we've elected a man who wants to speak loudly and carry a big stick, you know, what is the American public going to do, not just allow this impeachment proceeding, but in the effect that he actually tries to drive us into a war to save his presidency? You know, how are we going to deal with this? And are we going to look ourselves in the mirror and recognize that we're the bad guys?
Hmm. Teddy, thank you. Randy, what do you think?
Well, thanks for that, Teddy. It's difficult for any country to be honest about their own history. A few countries have managed it at least for moments of time.
Who?
Right? The one that I think is most impressive is Germany after World War II, right, which really grappled with the history of the Holocaust, and asked, how did we allow this to happen? What was wrong about us that allowed us to vote this person into office? And what went wrong with our institutions that prevented us from containing somehow the damage that he was able to do? And there's a profound cultural shift that happened in West Germany in the decades after World War II. After German unification, of course, things become more complicated because East Germany didn't have that educational process, and the eastern part of the country votes much more heavily for the right-wing party Alternative für Deutschland because they didn't go through an analogous process of self-examination. Somehow, it didn't fit with the agenda of the communist government that was running the country.
But to Teddy's point about trying to recognize sort of in process when you're going astray, when you are the one causing a conflict, when you are the one starting a war, yeah, I don't remember the name. There was a Democratic senator who told NPR just a couple of days ago when we were trying to assess the missile response from Tehran, you know, if there are dead Americans in that Iraqi base, which again, it turns out apparently there were not, but he said, if there were dead Americans there, he said, I see no way that we wouldn't have to hit them back in an even bigger way. I mean, you already have Democratic senators.
Mm-hmm.
This is not just, I mean, we have a cycle in this country. There are a lot of Democrats who swore to the Iraq War in 2003. And you've got a lot of people who get paid a lot of money in the media to be pundits who are still on the air. I mean, Sean Hannity was daring people to take a bet in October of 2003 about weapons of mass destruction. And he said, you're all going to have egg on your face when we find these labs, these weapons labs, when we prove that you're all wrong. He is one of the highest paid figures in American media 17 years later. And that guy's ability to say I was wrong was surgically removed at birth. What, I don't know how we sort of avoid some of that. I mean, and to Teddy's question seems to be, if it's happening again, we don't know yet, but like, how do you get to a point where you're not going to be the one who launches a war and has people cheering it and supporting it when it's wrong? I don't know. I don't know how to do that. As a society, we haven't done very well with that.
No, that's right. That's right. And once you get locked into a cycle of you know, tit for tat retaliation, you're right back to the Capulets and the Montagues. You know, the rivalry goes on and it escalates and so on. And I think that's right. That if Americans had been killed in that counterattack, we probably would have counterattacked again, and that would have led to further escalations and. This is precisely why you don't do something so incendiary as in assassinating a top leader of a foreign country.
That's why I look at the missile strike from Tehran that apparently killed nobody this week. I'm not an expert, but it's hard to buy that this was just calculation from Iran that was designed to end this thing with a show of force but not kill anybody. Because if there happened to be two stragglers on the ground, two people, just two Americans still at that base who lost their lives this week, their names would be known just about, and they'd be all over the news in every household, and it would be like, what are we going to do in response to this? We'd already be on our way. So maybe we got lucky.
And our defense secretary, Mark Esper, undermined the narrative that it was a deliberate face-saving kind of action. And he pointed out that based on where the missiles landed, it appeared that they had been targeted for to do maximum damage. They just happened not to. There were apparently 16 missiles fired from various positions in Iran. 11 of them hit two different bases, and 5 of them missed. So if they missed the bases with a third of the missiles that they fired, you can't believe that they were terribly surgical about where they caused the others to land.
Well, for another view on this, Bob and Shalat next. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, Evan, I got to say, you know, look, man, for you to get down on Sean Hannity, and I'm no fan, but for him, for you to say that he was surgically removed at birth to admit that he was wrong, kind of the kettle calling the pot black on this. I mean, I am a Trump supporter all the way. Don't like the guy, want to hang out with him, but as my president, I love him. Okay? Let me tell you what. How many times have you guys spewed your progressive, liberal, democratic crap where we would have been right in the crapper as a country if the Obama administration carried on with Hillary? All right? How many lives have been lost before this guy got wiped out? And I'm not into killing, but sometimes you are in life either a puncher or a punching bag. We are no longer going to be a punching bag, and you sit there and liberally spew about everything. The other thing is this. Why don't you talk about how George Soros tried to buy the nomination for the DA Democratic candidate here in Monroe County? Why don't you talk about that?
We did.
Why don't you talk about something meaty?
Oh, no, no, no. We had a whole conversation. In fact, we had both candidates for DA, and we were glad to have both of them. And we talked about that one at length.
I'm just getting sick, Evan, of the Republican Trump supporter middle America, who is always the Archie Bunker knuckle-dragging moron in this nation, as you have these self-congratulatory, elitist, stroking progressives on your show all the time, letting us know that we're a bunch of idiots because we support Trump. And what's wrong with the system? What's wrong with the Electoral College? What is right with it? Because I would hate to think where we'd be today with more Obama administration legacies with Hillary.
All right. So Bob, let me address a couple of those points, and I appreciate the phone call. First of all, look, man, you're not going to get me to budge on Sean Hannity. That guy is terrible for this country. I am sorry. And you know what? I'm sure there are liberal analogs. Few, or if anybody, seem to have sort of his reach and power. But no, you got to get yourself off the Hannity drug. That's really bad for people. Cable news is bad for people. This country's got a cable news problem, and it ain't just Fox News, but that... Anyway, and on the subject of whether I can admit I'm wrong, I am wrong all the time, man, and I am more than happy to say so. I can give you a long list, but let's not waste our time with that. I am wrong often, and I am humbled often. On the subject of how you feel as a Trump supporter listening to this program, maybe that's on me. I don't want anybody to feel like you say an Archie Bunker character. I don't think Trump supporters are stupid. I don't think that Trump supporters are idiots. I don't think Sanders supporters are stupid. I don't think Warren supporters are stupid. I don't think William Weld's vast legion of supporters are stupid. I think people come to their views through intellectually honest means, you included. I'm pointing out in the op-ed in the Wall Street Journal that people get pretty hard to move. Things are pretty intractable. And that is especially true among the president's supporters. That's just what we know. I mean, the president's own policies are going to put this company in Pittsburgh out of business. And the guy who runs the company says, I will still vote for him, even though he did this to our company. I just wish he would only do it to other companies. That just seems incoherent to me. It's hard for me to understand. Again, I don't think he's stupid. I'm trying to understand the psychology of it. So if you think that we're picking on people, I apologize for that. That is not the intention at all. Now, on the subject of, you know, we're in a world, Randy Stoney says, where sometimes you got to hit harder. You know, it's a dangerous world. And if you don't punch, you're going to get punched. Are there moments where that's true?
Oh, I think that there are moments when the use of force is called for and is necessary. And I think that World War II was such a moment. I think it's been very rare in our history that the United States has been wise about when it went to war. This is true of other countries as well, right? That international conflict is usually ill-advised. It's always very counterproductive, at least for one side and usually for both sides, right? Acting tough is not usually the best way to promote national security. Being predictable and credible is much more effective. Right. So take an example. Donald Trump decided to withdraw American troops from the northern border of Syria. And he did this apparently on a whim against the advice of all of his top advisors, reversing a number of years of U.S. policy, which had been very consistently pursuing the goal of ending the threat of ISIS. Right? Now, you could disagree about whether that was a worthwhile project and so forth, but that had been U.S. policy and had considerable treasure and blood had been spilled in order to achieve that goal. And on a whim, he reversed whatever progress had been made and essentially turned Syria over to Russia, Iran, and Turkey. This kind of inconsistency really undermines American security. And it outraged our NATO allies, who had been working with us in good faith on this project that we said we were interested in carrying out. Right. So now when Trump tries to herd a bunch of NATO allies into supporting a new conflict with Iran, as he was doing this week, they're having nothing of it. They're not interested in cooperating on this. They disagree on every point of his policy towards Iran, and they've been burned by him repeatedly. Right? Why would they stick their necks out to trust him? So our capabilities are reduced. Our objectives are frustrated because we can't pursue a thought from start to finish. And our policies are counterproductive.
I'm horrified to see that it's already 12:42. I wish we had 2 hours with you. Let's take our late-only break. When we come back, we're going to take more of your phone calls. We're going to try to squeeze in one of the reasons Randy's here. You were back in Moscow last month?
That's right.
Okay, so there's more to talk about there, and we'll answer more of your questions via email with Randy Stone, who is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies at the University of Rochester. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about AI, artificial intelligence. Sometimes AI can be sexist. AI can be racist. AI can be classist. Human beings create and program AI. And more, machine learning is making some big decisions about our world. So how do we make sure it is truly fair? AI and fairness, next hour. Let's move quickly. Linda in Penfield, next with Randy Stone. Go ahead, Linda.
Hi, Evan. Hello, Dr. Stone.
Hi, Linda.
I've done some personal research on my own about how voters decide, you know, whether to vote one way or the other way. And there's some research by a fellow named Jonathan Haidt, which is H-A-I-D-T,
yep,
who looked at this. And I don't mean to be monolithic about this. This is his research. What he found was that with folks who tend to lean a little more conservatively, it's based on thoughts about tradition, authority, law and order, purity, those sorts of things. So I guess I'm not too surprised about two things. One is that many workers, and this is true even in our town, where people thought Kodak was the big daddy, Xerox was the big daddy that was going to take care of everything, and et cetera, et cetera. And the person who just called in from Charlotte perfectly made this point. He supports Trump because he's the big daddy, and he's going to take care of everything, and he's not going to let us get pushed around. And what we do with that is subject for another program. My thought is, if I could sit with Bob and hear his personal story, because if I say facts and he says facts and George Soros and Hillary and blah, 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 we're not going to get anywhere. But what I would love to know is his personal story behind how he believes what he believes. And that's all I have to offer on that. So thanks for listening.
Linda, thank you. And I think that that's a good admonition for all of us. Don't assume the worst about your fellow Americans. That's important, especially as things get more heated as we go toward November, because it's only going to get more heated, I think. So, Linda, thank you very much for that call. Hey, so let's talk a little bit about Ukraine. Let's talk about some news in the last hour from CBS News and the Associated Press. U.S. officials believe that Iran shot down a Ukraine International Airlines passenger plane on Wednesday. According to CBS News, the Associated Press, and multiple other news outlets, citing government sources. The Kiev-bound plane crashed shortly after taking off from Tehran's airport, killing all 176 people on board. The belief is that was an accidental shooting down of the plane, according to sources. And here's how NBC News categorizes it. Spy satellite evidence suggests Ukraine International Airlines passenger airliner was shot down by mistake by Iranian anti-aircraft missiles in Iran. Wow. How is this going to play?
Well, this is a surprise to me. I didn't see this.
That is brand new.
If that's the case, it's tragic. I guess it's another consequence of the militarized situation that the region finds itself in. Ordinarily, people operating these sorts of missile defense batteries and so forth have a little bit of time. They don't have to be too trigger happy. But as the tension, the situation escalates, mistakes get made.
Oh, that is a really, really rough one. And the Canadian government's going to be closely involved because there were more than 60 Canadians on board out of the 176 passengers, many of them students, I think, studying in Ukraine. So that's news to follow. Teresa says, can Randy please talk about Ukraine? I'm concerned that Trump's undermining of our official pro-democracy diplomacy has pushed it and perhaps other countries toward corrupt oligarchy. Do you agree? That's from Teresa.
Well, yes. The situation in Ukraine is rather complicated, but it's true that a relatively small number of billionaires has an awful lot of influence in Ukrainian politics. The evidence that's come out in the impeachment trials, the investigation in the House and so forth, indicates that the administration was promoting all of the worst tendencies of Ukrainian politics in its effort to try to get some leverage in our own election. So that can't be helpful. Meanwhile, Ukraine continues to be locked in a ongoing war with Russia. There've been over 10,000 casualties since 2014, and while that has cooled down a bit on the Eastern Front, it continues, and people continue to be killed. Eastern two districts of Ukraine, Lugansk and Donetsk, are still controlled by essentially a Russian puppet regime, which is supplied and army is staffed mostly by Russian soldiers and officers, and the there's kind of a no man's land between that territory and the rest of Ukraine, and there are casualties there almost every week.
What was your work? What did it entail in December, last month, in Moscow? Tell me about that.
So this is part of a regular group of meetings that we've been having since 2010 to explore potential for U.S.-Russian relations. And when we started these meetings, we were in the midst of the reset, and we were full of hope. And it was a group of Russian, mostly academics, some policy officials, and on the American side, mostly academics, a few people from think tanks, some in and out of government. And we've been meeting regularly, and our the tenor of the conversations has changed, so that I have to say that as we've gotten to know each other better and our personal relations have become warmer and warmer, the gap between our understanding of the world has just gotten larger, right? So that we now find it very difficult to agree about basic facts We have very different expectations about what will happen in the future, very different normative interpretations of each other's policies and so on. So it kind of mirrored the increasing lack of understanding within American politics. It felt like the gap that's emerged between Fox and MSNBC. We live in these two different bubbles and don't communicate with each other. Similarly, the Americans and the Russians are finding it harder and harder to understand each other.
What do we where do we go from here in terms of our policy with Russia in this administration if we continue? If this administration becomes an 8-year administration, what's on the horizon that stands out to you vis-a-vis Russia, vis-a-vis Ukraine?
Well, I think that controversy will probably continue about Russian intervention in U.S. elections, as it doesn't seem to me that significant steps have been made to prevent a recurrence of what happened in 2016, and we will have that happen again, and I think Russia is still interested, as disappointed as they are, frankly, in the Trump administration. They see the Trump administration as a vast improvement.
Why are they disappointed in the Trump administration?
They had elevated expectations that they thought he was their guy, and he would drop the sanctions. He would take a pragmatic view and just make business deals and so forth. And now they say, well, he's kind of been trapped by our dysfunctional. They're referring to the United States, the dysfunctional political system. And so he really doesn't have the freedom of maneuver to do what he would like to do. The opposition is kind of forcing him to take a confrontational view on Ukraine. They see it as a confrontational view. I think it's actually a fairly accommodative view, and much, much more so than they had any right to expect. What they see as the really positive thing that's come up recently in Trump foreign policy from their perspective is our trade war with China. To the extent that we ruin our relations with China, we drive China to be more accommodating toward Russia. And they see this as a very good thing.
Hmm. By the way, some of that push-pull, If Russia's right, it's not just sort of this bifurcation of right-left. I mean, the president himself has had a cabinet filled with people who oppose him on Russia. So it's just an interesting dynamic. Let me get back to your phone calls. And this is Benjamin in Pittsburgh next. Go ahead, Benjamin.
Hello. While I waited, I think I might have answered my question. So hear me out on this one. All right. So Trump, I don't care what side of the aisle you're on, I think he's a national embarrassment for a couple of reasons. He lost the national popular vote. The UN National Assembly literally laughed at him when he said he had the most effective administration ever. He's being beat by a 16-year-old Greta Thunberg on Twitter. It's clear. In an ideal world, I think politicians and world leaders would just wait till he's gone. There's better people on the horizon. I don't care if they're Republican or Democrat. There's better people. We can agree on that. But clearly, there's a bunch of cynical world leaders out there who can get Trump to acquiesce to what they want just simply by buttering them up. We've seen it North Korea, MBS. Erdogan and Turkey. It's ridiculous. I mean, I just wish people would do the best attack to Trump's ego by just ignoring him and waiting till it's over, but that's just not going to happen. Hmm. All right, cool. That's it.
Benjamin, thanks for the phone call there. What do you make of that, Randy?
Well, you make a good point about North Korea and Turkey as countries that I don't think it's particularly good for the country in either case, but leaders who have gotten a lot of what they wanted from Donald Trump because his attention wanders, because he's not a very good negotiator, because he doesn't really know what the stakes are. And so his inclination is to make short-term deals, which seem to him to give him some sort of a political advantage, usually in American domestic politics. often at the expense of U.S. long-term interests or objectives around the world.
In our last minute here, in all seriousness, some of the biggest and gravest concerns about any administration, but particularly expressed by even members of the Republican Party about this administration, is you might have a sort of vaguely irrational actor at the head of our country, and the last thing we would want to see is an actual war, us pulled into a violent conflict, and that we've largely avoided it. I'm not saying we haven't been. I'm not saying we're not at war, et cetera. Are you concerned that what's happening in Iran represents some of those worst fears? Or do you think that, that's still a ways away?
Well, I've thought all along that Iran was the most likely place for us to get involved in a war in Trump's presidency. There was a time early in the administration where there was a lot of concern about Korea. And I thought that was unlikely to materialize, but I thought that Iran was more likely. So I still think that's the case. I think there, you know, the strategy of using preemptive war in order to win elections doesn't really work that well. But that doesn't mean that someone won't try it, right? And so I think there is concern about that.
Well, we always appreciate your expertise and your time, and sometimes answering events in real time as we're learning more about the downed Ukrainian airliner in Iran. But thanks. Thanks for being here to share that expertise and your time with us. Randy is the director of the Skolny Center for Polish and Central European Studies and a professor of political science at the University of Rochester. We look forward to the next conversation.
My pleasure, Evan. Good to be with you.
All right. Short break. More connections coming up.